listening to The Star Spot, episode 89 for Sunday, November 15th, 2015.
I'm Justin Trottier, and I'll be your host at The Star Spot. The Star Spot is a space-themed podcast that focuses on all aspects of astronomy and space exploration. Episodes feature interviews with guests of wide-ranging backgrounds: scientists, engineers, educators, artists, politicians, and business people. Topics are similarly broad, from the latest space mission to how the universe began, from why humans explore to how we can make exploration economical. We'll also include a segment called Current in Space, bringing you reports on news and developments that may interest the space enthusiast. You can now find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/thestarspot or follow us on Twitter at @thestarspot. There was once a time when scientists believed that beyond the Earth, there lied a largely dry, barren, and inhospitable solar system. But now we think there is likely to be liquid water below the surface of Jupiter's moons, Ganymede and Europa, a warm, salty ocean below the crust of Saturn's moon, Enceladus, and recently NASA confirmed that ancient lakes once flowed on Mars. As the solar system wettens, are we witnessing a paradigm shift with profound implications in our search for life? To help us answer that question, today I'm joined at the Star Spot by the self-described professional ice finder, David Page. But first, here's what's current in space.
What exactly is the microbiome in the International Space Station? That is, what sort of microbial organisms live in the ISS other than humans? Bacteria, of course. The ISS is quite a unique environment, posing a wide variety of pressures on living organisms other than humans. The cosmic radiation, microgravity, constant human habitation, and high CO2 levels are just such pressures. In fact, last week, a team of biologists led by Dr. Kasturi Venkateswaran at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab have used novel DNA sequencing technology to identify specific bacteria in terms of size and diversity living in the ISS, as well as model ISS rooms here on Earth called clean rooms. As outlined in their paper in the journal Microbiome, the team analyzed air filter deposits and vacuum dust from the ISS. Using a deep sequencing technique called 16S rRNA gene tagging and propidium monoazide quantitative polymerase chain reaction assays, the scientists discovered three dominant bacterial phyla: actinobacteria, Firmicutes, and proteobacteria. Actinobacteria were most prevalent in the ISS, while proteobacteria were most prevalent in the clean rooms. Specifically, Corynebacterium and Propionibacterium within the Actinobacterial phylum, but not Staphylococcus, which is from the Firmicutes phylum, were dominant on the ISS. Interestingly, the Actinobacteria are relatively benign bacteria normally found on human skin. The fact that more harmful Staphylococcus were not found in significant quantities on the ISS is in fact good news for the astronauts, who obviously don't want to get sick isolated 400 kilometers up. In the ISS, at least 6 astronauts are always present, and the air is constantly recycled, so it is important to understand its microbiome in terms of human health. It would aid in the identification of regions needing more extensive sanitization, for example, washrooms and food storage areas. Cleanliness is key here. It becomes even more important when considering astronaut health in long-distance missions, perhaps to Mars, which may be on the horizon with the Orion spacecraft. Microbiologists have long known now that the number of prokaryotes, chiefly bacteria, outnumber the number of eukaryotic cells that make up the human body by about 10 to 1. That is a staggering number. It has been said that we ourselves are microbiome of sorts. Just to put this into perspective, 205 different genera of bacteria live on our skin alone, and 400 species of bacteria live in our gut. But the important thing for NASA is to identify and mitigate the presence and adverse effects of harmful bacteria for humans in space. And, as DNA sequencing technology develops in the future, NASA's applications become all the more important.
Excitement for fans of the Star Wars franchise has never been higher. With the release of the hotly anticipated Episode 7 only about a month and a half away, it's only going to increase. Although almost everyone has already purchased their tickets, that only adds more fire to what is surely an agonizing wait. But why not hear about something scientific with a connection to Star Wars to pass the time? Recently, a discovery was made out in space that may be of interest to fans of the galaxy far, far away, as an object akin to the Death Star, the Galactic Empire's spherical planet killer, has been detected. Only that object is no space station, but a white dwarf star. Located approximately 570 light-years distant, in the constellation Virgo, the star was observed by NASA's Kepler-K2 mission, which monitors stars for dips in brightness caused by transiting planets, in addition to other astrophysical observations. As it stared at the white dwarf, designated WD1145, Kepler detected regular dips in brightness, occurring every 4.5 hours, the telltale sign of a minor planet or other rocky body orbiting at a distance of about 520,000 miles from the star. This makes WD1145 the very first white dwarf discovered to have a planetary body transiting it. Lead study author Andrew Vandenberg of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and colleagues were in for another surprise when they made additional observations of the star using a multitude of ground-based facilities, one of which was the Keck Observatory. To learn more about the Keck, check out episode 85, featuring an interview with Keck director Hilton Lewis. Once all the observational data was gathered, it revealed evidence of not one, but multiple bodies, each in orbits between 4.5 and 5 hours. The primary transit from the main body dimmed the starlight by a shocking 40%, while the transit signal also gave off a pattern similar to that displayed by comets, thereby implying an extended dust cloud was encircling the main body. The direct result of the white dwarf's intense heat and light vaporizing the surfaces of the one or more planetoids. Vandenberg's team also found signs of heavy elements polluting the atmosphere of the white dwarf, such as calcium, silicon, magnesium, and iron in its light spectrum. This was quite mysterious, since a white dwarf's surface normally consists of light elements like hydrogen and helium, while the star's ferocious gravity should sink the heavier elements into the interior. In fact, astronomers had initially theorized that the source of this so-called pollution were rocky planets or asteroids being disintegrated by the white dwarf's gravity. Well, theory no more, as the WD1145 system is the literal smoking gun linking white dwarf pollution to planetary destruction, as it features a polluted white dwarf, an encircling debris disk, and at least one rocky object in orbit. Currently, the planetoids orbiting WD1145 are being fried by the star's horrific heat. But over the next million years, they will spiral so close to the star that they will be crumbled into dust by the gravitational tides. Talk about a death star. While it's not the work of an evil galactic empire, WD1145 is an awesome example of the universe's natural processes and the mighty forces they wield.
And that's what's current in space. David Page is professor of planetary sciences at UCLA. He is principal investigator of the Diviner Lunar Radiometer Experiment, an instrument aboard NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter mission that is currently orbiting the Moon. He made headlines in 2012 for the discovery of water ice deposits and organic material on Mercury using data collected by the MESSENGER spacecraft. Page is a world authority on water, ices, and volatiles in the solar system. Well, I'm very excited to be joined here at the Star Spot by Professor David Page. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Professor Page, I think you describe yourself as a, quote, professional ice finder. So I'm curious how you got into that profession. What does that mean?
Well, of course, there's a lot about the solar system that we don't know. And for whatever reason, I've always been sort of attracted to cold places just because they're very interesting. And, you know, just as a byproduct of that, we often find a lot of ice that's migrated into cold areas. And so That's one of the things that I've sort of built my career on in terms of looking for ice and finding some in some cases.
And as a Canadian-based podcast and radio show, we definitely understand your interest in finding ice, and we don't have any trouble finding it up here. But we've also noticed that water ice in particular is easier to find than we thought it would be in many parts of the solar system. We've had, as you well know, discoveries of a potential warm, salty ocean on Enceladus, the moon of Saturn, liquid water that we now think exists below the surface of Ganymede, certainly Europa, these moons of Jupiter. We've had recent news from NASA of a much wetter Martian past, and of course your work with Mercury and also studying ice water on the moon. We once thought the solar system was much more dry and barren. Are we seeing something of a paradigm shift in our understanding of how habitable, or at least how prevalent these volatiles are across the solar system?
Yeah, well, the general paradigm was that the outer solar system was icy, and the inner solar system was largely free of ice, and that's just because of what we know about the volatility of ice. It'll tend to be condensed at the temperatures we find in the outer solar system. But, you know, as we explore the planets more, we find all sorts of interesting niches for night ice where it's cold and it can be stable. So, yeah, it's exciting. I mean, we don't find ice any place where we know where it ought not to be, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, there's no magic ice that can stay frozen even though the temperature conditions are too high for it. We're just finding, places where it's cold and the ice can be stable, which, of course, is also very interesting.
If I were to ask you to sort of survey the solar system in terms of locations where would have been skeptical maybe 20 or 30 years ago that we would find water ice, and now we have found it, are you saying most locations in the inner solar system we would have said probably don't have water ice, except, of course, Earth, but now they're there, whether it's the Moon or Mercury or even Venus, I think, has water, some water in its atmosphere. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, well, I think the number one surprise is probably Mercury, since it's the closest planet to the sun and has, among the hottest temperatures in the entire solar system. But yet there are places at the poles where sunlight doesn't shine. There's, craters and topographic obstacles that prevent direct sunlight right at the poles. And these places get extremely cold. As cold as, almost any place in the outer solar system. And when we didn't necessarily have to find ice there, but somehow it found its way there. So that's very interesting. Like, Venus is pretty much a write-off in terms of ice. It's very hot everywhere. Earth, of course, we know the story on ice. Moon, it's been hypothesized there could be ice there. But it was an open question as to whether it might be there. And, we certainly found some very good evidence for it, at least at one location. The jury's out in terms of how ice-rich the moon really is, but we certainly know there's some there. The story on Mars is we knew there was ice there from the polar cap, and we had a theoretical case that there ought to be ice below the surface, but then, as we looked with greater detail, we find more ice and purer ice than we had expected, even at lower latitudes where we might not expect ice to be stable under the current climate. So that's, of course, very exciting. We're finding evidence for ice out in the asteroid belt, which is sort of right, at the Earth, at the solar system's ice line. Sometimes we see, asteroids collide and we see evidence of water being liberated there. So there is definitely, a fair amount of ice in the asteroid belt. And then beyond that, we're basically at temperatures in the solar system where we'd expect ice to be stable. And I think what's so interesting is that, basically everywhere you look in the outer solar system, you see evidence for lots and lots of ice. Hmm. So in a sense, ice is just another thing that solar systems, planetary systems, and planets are made out of, and it's a very abundant material. If you look at cosmic abundance, hydrogen, oxygen are are very abundant materials. And so, as with many things in science, once you think about it, it's not so surprising. But, you know, it's taken us a while to get to this point to realize just how accurate the solar system really is.
If we look at the world of Mercury as an example of where we have found a prevalence of water ice that we didn't originally expect in such quantities, and of course it's work that you've been very much a pioneer on, what are some of the major explanations for why the water ice is there?
Well, you know, it's kind of a detective story, right? You've got the evidence, which is that there's ice there, and then the question is sort of who done it. And there are a few suspects. One is that, and there's also a timing question as well. When did it happen and who done it? There are a lot of different ways in which you could get the water and either hydrogen or oxygen, for that matter, into the vicinity of Mercury. These are elements that are coming off the sun in the form of the solar wind. So that's one possible explanation. There's also gassing from the interior of Mercury, you know, from the interior of the planet in the form of volcanoes, which we know water is a constituent of gas that comes out of volcanoes on the Earth and the Moon, for instance. This could have been a source of the water we see trapped at the poles on Mercury. And then there are a variety of sort of comets and asteroids which come from the outer solar system that where water ice is stable, that, you know, could have found their way and impacted Mercury, and then the water could have migrated to the poles. And the second question, of course, is when it happened. Is this a artifact of something that happened very early on when the solar system was first forming, or is this a process that's ongoing even to the present day? And the data we have on Mercury, given how extremely well-organized all the ice appears to be on Mercury, is that certainly there's a component that's occurring in the present day. It can't all be ancient ice, because we still see the ice, you know, exposed on the surface, for instance, in certain places.
That ice would have evaporated away by now. Is that the argument?
Or gotten disrupted by meteor comet impacts or a variety of other loss processes that probably would not make it stable right on the surface.
Gotcha. You've also discussed in some of your lectures, and I was privileged to have seen your recent talk at the University of Toronto, where you went into detail on how the ice on Mercury is found in a, quote, ordered state. Can you explain what that means, an organized state? What does that mean, that the ice is in an organized state?
Well, the idea here is that, you know, we have very good estimations of what the temperatures of the surface and subsurface on Mercury ought to be. This is made possible by the fact that we got very detailed topographic data from Mercury back from the MESSENGER orbiting spacecraft, which just recently crashed this year. And it's possible to predict, based on temperature, whether you expect to find ice on the surface or below the surface. And in a lot of the places that we look, the models we have for where we might predict ice to be present, let's say on the surface, are borne out by observations. We can actually see evidence for ice on the surface in those places. And then in places where we expect to see ice below the surface, we see ice below the surface, for instance, in the form of radar backscatter measurements. And what we don't expect to see ice, there's no evidence of it. So it makes for a very good correlation between predictions and observations. That's what we mean by an ordered state.
And so some of the locations where we often find them, I think you explained this in your lecture, are in the shadows of craters. And is that because those shadows obviously prevent illumination from the sun, so it keeps that area relatively cool even on an otherwise warm surface?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that keeps things in the solar system from cooling down to, you know, the temperature of space, you know, 3 degrees above absolute zero, is the fact that the sun is shining on it. And when you take that away, things can get very, very cold. And on Mercury, near the poles, you can get, you know, situations like that in the bottoms of craters. There's a small amount of light that gets scattered off of the rims of craters, and there's infrared radiation that gets emitted from those rims and also gets onto the surfaces of these areas. But for the most part, there's almost no light and no radiation hitting them, and therefore they just cool off to the temperature of space. It's rather remarkable that you can get to cold areas without, you know, even though you're so close to the sun.
Gotcha. So if I understand, whether the ice is found on the surface or, you know, just under the surface or not at all, will be correlated to essentially the amount of illumination or the lack of illumination in terms of how hot that local region of the planet's surface is going to get.
Right. And the fact that we see ice in all these places means there's a pretty good supply of water coming into Mercury to keep all those areas populated with ice.
Well, this was my follow-up question. So in terms of this organized state that we find, what does that tell us about the origin of the ice? And so am I to understand it tells us that it's a fairly recent origin? It must have happened, you know, long after the original supply of water ice would have run out on the planet?
Well, again, we're still in this detective mode. We're not quite sure where it's coming from or what combination of sources it's coming from.
Right.
So it's difficult for us to say, you know, that there's even a history going on, because, you know, it could all be recent, or it could be, you know, old and recent combined. So all those are, you know, possible scenarios given, you know, what we're able to see so far.
Right.
But certainly when you see things, you know, in what appears to be a very, you know, organized, predictable state, that certainly means that there's some, you know, active process that's maintaining it.
We've also been discovering these dark deposits in some of these, again, shadowy cratered areas on Mercury. What accounts for those dark deposits?
Well, these were, you know, an even bigger surprise than water. We had hints of the water, you know, well before, for instance, the Messenger mission, you know, in this decade. But when we got to Mercury and we looked at the surfaces of some of these areas that are cold enough to have ice below the surface but not cold enough to have ice on the surface, we found that the surface was extremely dark in these areas. And just to give you some perspective here, the moon is a very dark body. You know, if you were to look at some moon dust, it would look sort of dark gray. Whereas Mercury is, the surface of Mercury, even the parts that aren't covered by this weird dark stuff, are already very cold. They're as dark as almost like a lump of coal, if you were to look at it. But these dark areas are even darker than the rest of Mercury. So they are some of the darkest material we can find anywhere in the solar system. And this appears to coat the surface below the areas where ice is stable. And this is a complete unexpected discovery. When you look at the solar system in general and look around for dark material like this, you can find them in a couple contexts. One is inside meteorites. There's a lot of meteorites that are carbon-rich, and they appear very, very dark. Sometimes, in some cases, 10 or 20% of the content of these meteorites consists of dark organic matter that's been highly processed and turned into these PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. These are sort of like soot. They're very difficult to break down with ultraviolet radiation. And appear to be very stable. They're the product of a lot of processing organics to get into this state. You find them inside certain types of organic-rich meteorites. You also find them on the surfaces of comets, for instance. The comet nuclei we looked at often look very dark and have the same sort of organic material that covers them. And so the processing of this material is something that happens out in space. It's not due to biologic processes. It's simply just organic chemistry and physical chemistry creating this material. But in many cases, it may be due to the fact that, you know, there's been a certain amount of loss of ice, and this material sort of worked its way sort of up to the surface. It's very exciting that we find it there. That certainly drives us in the direction that there's some input of material potentially, you know, from the outer solar system where this stuff is probably more common. And it's impacted Mercury and also made its way to the polar region.
So what we're discovering, it sounds like it's not just water ice that we're finding in these places where we didn't think we'd find as much, but it's also these organics.
Right. And this has quite an interesting significance to the whole question of the origin of life. Mm-hmm. What, you know, the Earth is covered with organic material, right? But all this material, for the most part, has been synthesized, you know, by life on the Earth from inorganic constituents. In other words, you know, it's taken the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen out of the physical world and then created organics from that. But for life to get started, you basically have to have a pre-existing reservoir of organic material from which to get the original chemistry of life going. And it's this extraterrestrial source of organic material, originally synthesized in the interstellar medium, that is believed to be the original stock that that life itself arose from.
Gotcha. You mentioned a little bit earlier, the moon, and you've done, you know, a lot of work on the moon as well. So I'm wondering if you could offer a bit of a comparison. Are Mercury and the moon similar enough that the kind of work that you've done on one body can inform or support research on the other?
Oh, yes. I mean, certainly the moon and Mercury, you know, bear quite a familial resemblance in the fact that they're both ancient surfaces, airless bodies, and both have cold polar regions. We've done similar analyses that we've done on Mercury and the moon and predicted that there are even larger cold traps, deeper cold traps on the moon than on Mercury. It's further from the sun, et cetera. So if the moon were exactly like Mercury, what we might expect to find equivalently, you know, deep deposits of ice there as well. The data that we've gotten, especially from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, are very interesting, but we only get kind of a whiff of ice generally, and that's because the data we have, you know, seems to work be most relevant to sort of the top meter of the surface. But there could be quite a bit of ice buried at deeper depths than we're able to, you know, easily access with those types of data. And so for whatever reason, the moon's ice deposits are not nearly as fresh or as organized as those on Mercury. And to be honest, we really don't know exactly why that is.
Just in our last few minutes, I wonder if we can talk about some of the other things that we still don't fully understand that are still a mystery to us. For example, I recall in your presentation, you talked about how there seems to be too much water on some of the moons of the gas giants than can be accounted for by our current theories. Did I understand that correctly? And can you
elaborate? Well, I'm not sure that it's too much water, but certainly the water seems a lot more volatile than we would expect. In other words, we see lots of evidence for the fact that the surfaces of these moons have been, you know, refreshed on relatively short timescales. The surfaces are geologically young. Yes, when we look at our models for the processes that could generate heat inside these bodies, it's difficult for us to account for the fact that it appears to be so much activity going on. One would predict that they would have rather, you know, boring geological histories that involve maybe being warm early on and then, you know, gradually becoming quiescent and covered with impact craters. But the more of these bodies we look at close up, including Pluto, the more evidence we see for all kinds of activity on a variety of timescales and complicated histories. And so this seems rather puzzling to us, why these bodies would show so much activity, despite the fact that we would predict just on the basis of simple models that they would have pretty much cooled off by now.
And I guess some of that geologic activity is what is possibly warming these otherwise ice worlds and providing the possibility of, for example, on Europa or Enceladus, these subsurface oceans.
Absolutely. The surfaces of these bodies are very cold. You know, we can measure their temperatures and predict them, and they, you know, agree perfectly. But yet, there appears to be warm material below the surfaces at varying depths. And apparently, there's communication between these subsurface water worlds or oceans and the surface, you know, on relatively recent timescales. And, you know, sort of understanding those processes and why this all happens is, of course, one of the big challenges in our field.
What about our own world? Are there still mysteries left in terms of where the water on our planet came from?
Absolutely. Water, if you look at the Earth as a whole, is a very, very small fraction of the total mass. And anytime you know, the Earth is made dominantly composed of, silicates and metals, and the water is just a sort of thin coating on the surface, even though, you know, if you go up to the ocean or go up to a giant ice cap, it seems immense. On a scale of the planet as a whole, it's just a very, very thin covering. Hmm. And so because of that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the water we have on Earth necessarily came along with the silicates and iron. A variety of processes, not unlike the processes that we were puzzling about, which might be causing the mercury to have ice, were also probably responsible for the origination and maintenance of the Earth's atmosphere and oceans. And so studying these processes on other planets is very helpful in that they provide clues to this question about our own Earth and ultimately its habitability. We certainly know how much water is in the ocean and the polar caps. There are still questions about how much water is inside the interior of the Earth. We have, you know, a process called plate tectonics, which is, you know, gradually cycled material through the Earth's mantle over time. And there are major mysteries about, you know, how many more oceans worth of water might be inside the Earth and potentially accessible over geologic time. So that's certainly a question about the Earth that we'd like to also get an answer to.
Now, I can't let you go without one last question, and that's about the implications of your work in terms of our understanding of the habitability of solar systems outside of ours. What are we learning from your work on volatiles and especially the prevalence of an origin of water ice in our solar system? What knowledge is there that we can then extrapolate about some of the extrasolar worlds that we're discovering?
Well, of course, the data we have on extrasolar worlds is extremely exciting. Just the multitude of planets is the big message. But I think the work that we're doing inside our solar system shows that you can't just go by the standard expectations about where you might find water or ice or even life for that matter. The fact that the cold niches inside the Earth's solar system have abundant ice suggests that similar sorts of things might be going on in worlds far beyond our own. And while it's nice to find an Earth-like planet inside a sort of habitable zone in terms of temperature in its solar system, that doesn't mean there might be also something very interesting happening on a moon, or maybe even something a close-in planet that might be considered to be too hot to support liquid water as well. So all things are possible, I think, is the main message we get from our own solar system.
What a great message to conclude on. Professor David Page, thanks so much for joining us here at the Star Spot.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us at the Star Spot. Mind and universe continually expanding.
The Star Spot with Justin Trottier is an astronomy and space-themed podcast based out of Toronto, Canada. Please send comments or questions to starspotpodcast@gmail.com. The Star Spot is produced by Ying Zhang Li. Marketing and promotions by Natalie Morcos. Guest hosting by Denise Fong. News production by Benjamin Jenkins. News contributions from Julia Mazurchuk, Mallory Warren, Jessica Campbell, and Victoria Duncan. Web design by Blair Renault. Graphics by Carmina Svillens. And I'm your host, Justin Trottier. Thank you for listening.